This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
We have enemies within our country.
I think it's a combination of demonology and psyop.
The citizens are going to rise up and become deputized.
I have always supported President Trump. I like the way he talked. He reminded me of most men.
Joe Biden last night in the debate, it's like he's not even a human being.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represented extremism.
Can you imagine repatriating all the black Americans that Pat just spoke about to Africa?
Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen?
This is Profane Faith, a podcast that engages faith on the margins, faith that has been labeled profane, nonconformist, or even out there. We'll be exploring the intersections of the sacred, secular, and profane to find God. And look, we won't be trying to answer difficult questions. Rather, we'll be engaging them and asking better ones regarding faith, race, gender, and religion. I'll be your host, Daniel White Hodge. What's up, profane faithers? How y'all doing out there? Oh my goodness, I have an amazing guest today. I want to get right into the interview. I met this person through one of the people working at one of the publishers that sends out notices and then says, hey, you want to put this person on your podcast. And of course, I looked at the title and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a great book. But what I found with Prasanta was that we had kindred spirits, and just in regards to just life, kids, where we find ourselves connected. And I really wanted her to come on and just talk a little bit about just continuing down this line of how we deal with all the adversity that we're dealing with, right? This book, Beyond Ethnic Loneliness, The Pain of Marginalization and the Path to Belonging. I'm just trying to throw all these things at y'all because, I really believe no one really knows what the hell is going on in regards to a solution. Like, I think there are multiple solutions. I think the problems we face are way too complex to just be like, oh, well, let's just do this. So, in that same vein and energy, I wanted to put out various amounts of people dealing with issues of conflict and just getting their take. So this is another one. This is another person who's doing amazing work. I was excited to bring her on. I think at the end of the day, it's important that we just kind of begin to listen and see. Because ultimately, I strive for peace. I strive for peace. And, I don't want to be a person that, falls in love with an idea over people. I don't want to be the person that becomes a fundamentalist. I've talked about that a lot. I also don't want to be the person that just completely gives up. I'm almost there. I'm not going to lie. And I think folks like Prasanta have helped give me, I'll speak for myself, a different viewpoint and just to be able to think, okay, I think we can do this. Her work here is amazing. This particular book, I'm not going to steal the thunder. She's going to get into it. It's dealing specifically with, I think the title is what got me, this just dealing with ethnic loneliness. And that's something that I know that I have struggled with for a long time. I know that that's something that that I have engaged with on multiple levels. And I find that I find myself now in a place that is very unfamiliar. It's uncharted territory for me, especially as it relates to having black friends that are local, that are here. Okay. I can pretty much go almost any place in the country and feel at home in a city. Let me be specific, in a city. I feel like I can go and I know people and I can connect. And especially when I go to conferences, you know, there are a lot of folks that I can connect with via text, instant messages. But there's something about having just a community of people, especially as an ethnic minority, that, you know, you can just kick it with. And I feel like there's so much of that community that I have lost and I've never regained. And anytime I thought I had it, then the person either moves, turns out to be a flake, other issues come up, and, you know, it just turns into a real shit show. So I was really appreciative of her work, and I was excited to bring her here on the show. So we're just going to get right into it. This is the summer. You know, we're just going to hop right into this. Prasanta was born under an Asian sun, raised in the Appalachian foothills in the South, and now resides in the upper Midwest. She has essays and poetry that have been published in Sojourners, Propel Women, Encourage, Inheritance Magazine, the Indianapolis Review, Barron Magazine, and the Mudroom blog, excuse me. She served as a speech and debate coach for over 10 years. When she's not writing, speaking, or working, she's drinking chai, walking, or reading. And Prasanta lives with her family in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm excited to have her on and to have this conversation, particularly with what it means to be isolated in those environments. And ultimately, some steps, and dare I say steps, I would say some thoughts, some research around moving through that. If that makes sense. Yeah? All right. Here we go, fam. Check it out.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Prasanta, welcome to Profane Faith. Like I said before, I'm excited to have you on the show. I ask all guests the same question to start off with. And what has been happening from birth to now? What and who has made Prasanta Prasanta?
Wow. Well, thank you so much for having me. Great to be here with you. Wow. So what has been happening from birth to now that makes me me? A lot of things. I think number one that I would have to say would be immigration, because I am an immigrant. My parents are immigrants. And we moved from India to the United States. And so that has been an extremely formative experience in my life, being an immigrant, bicultural, growing up in the United States. So I would say that has formed me in many, many ways, probably more than many other things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's what's up. How's that process been, particularly coming to the U.S., you know, dealing with all the situations? I recently had a conversation with a colleague who's not from this country, wasn't born here, and so we were talking about race and ethnicity, and he was actually interviewing for a position, and we were asking him about race and ethnicity, and he was just like, well, you know, it's just such an American thing, it's just such a U.S. thing, and I was like, sure, but it is what we're dealing with, and we're kind of seeing that stuff play out in different college campuses and stuff. So how's that? What's that experience, you know, been like for you? And engaging with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I think it's been a question that I've had to answer and think about all of my life. You know, from the time I was a young child till today, I've had to think about what is my ethnicity? What is my background? How do I name myself? What do I call myself? Because growing up here, there were many different names and I didn't know where I fit. And so it's been this journey of trying to answer that question for myself. How do I define myself? What is my identity? And, you know, what is that going to be? What does that look like for me?
Yeah. No, for real. How has faith interwoven with that? I mean, because, you know, at least growing up Christian, there was always a sense that, oh, you know, I'm a Christian first, and then I'm, you know, fill in the blank with ethnicity. But it's just like, at least for me, as I've come to define, like, no, all these things are, you know, it's complicated. But what about for you? How's that interwoven with, you know, theology, the Bible, all of them good things?
Yeah. So I think so. When I became a believer when I was 13, okay. I grew up in the South, and so. And I, in the Deep South, you know, there were teachings there. It was a completely different environment. I live in the Midwest now, and I've been away from the South for so long. Mm-hmm. So I guess, well, part one of the answer to your question is I had to go through my own spiritual healing in terms of when I was young, I was kind of mad at God. Like, God, why did you make me this way? If you wanted me to live in America, why am I looking like an Indian American? You know, so I had to go through my own spiritual healing and my own personal reconciliation with who God made me and how He made me, and not just accept it, but just to believe that it's good. So that was a whole thing I had to experience. Of course, then there's the identity of being a believer and how that plays in with my who I am and my value system. So that's also part of my identity woven in there. But then there's also just, you know, growing up in the teaching in the South, I had to disentangle myself from a lot of that teaching, which I wasn't really, I was kind of like in an echo chamber there. You know, I didn't even realize it until I had been removed and for a number of years. So that also played a part too in my my faith, my growth in my faith and my identity.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, that you pulled that up as you were talking, I was also thinking, like, how has whiteness, white supremacy, you know, kind of these constructs, as they call it, right, the white gaze, how has that played a role in just how we define it, or has it? I don't know. Again, you know, I haven't been born here in the U.S. and navigating the world as a racially Black man, ethnically, I'm African American and my mom's Mexican American, mm-hmm. but navigating it as Black, you know, I walk outside, I'm Black, you know, mm-hmm. there's always that kind of that white gaze, right, and how folks perceive you as a threat and engage with that. You know, mm-hmm. I've had people clutching their purses, all those things, locking doors. Yeah. But how has that been, you know, for you in particular?
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. So yes, for me, that experience was I basically realized I had internalized racism, and basically I kind of grew up not, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, and I have language for it now, but basically wasn't happy with my identity, wanted to change it. I wanted to be white. So I had internalized this whole idea that white is superior. And that is really what I really needed to be to get my way in the world. And if I were white, oh, all my problems would be solved. So this is kind of the language, the internal language that I had going on with myself for years. Yeah. And it kind of like subconsciously, you know, I wasn't even always aware of it. It just was part of my existence. So I definitely had internalized that this was the normative thing to do, to be, was white, and that was superior. And so I grew up with that. And there were times, you know, I would walk into spaces and I would feel, it's nothing like what you experienced, you know, because they're different experiences, but I would definitely feel like, okay, there's a brown woman who just walked into the room. And then, you know, when you walk into a space, maybe you do this too. You look around and you're counting, okay, how many other people like me are in this room? And so you walk into a room and you automatically feel, or you know, that you're different, and other people notice it, right? Yeah. Then there's other places and spaces where you walk in and it's not that like that. You walk in and you're like, okay, I feel a little more comfortable in this space. There's more people of color in this room. And, you know, it's a little bit of a different feel. And I think, and as an Asian American, especially as an Asian Indian, there's also this model minority, you know, that myth, like the model minority myth, where, you know, you're an Asian Indian, you're expected to be good at math, and you're going to be a smart student. You're probably going to be a doctor or something, like, or an engineer or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I also grew up with that. And so, so there were those kinds of experiences that I had with my ethnic identity.
No, that's deep. I mean, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that that model minority stuff, that stuff runs deep. I think especially, you know, just trying to navigate through so much of particularly evangelicalism. You know, for me, evangelicalism has just been a scourge on Christianity. But that's a different conversation. But my point being is that so much of it, you know, is rooted in, you know, in whiteness. You think about, you know, who writes our commentaries and, you know, who puts out Bibles and stuff like that. And so anyways, long story short, the point is that it's so much of that stuff is embedded in, and so no, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. So what's the genesis then for this book? What's how did you come to be like, all right, I need to put this down in a format. We're gonna read some stuff here. How did this come about?
Yeah. So part of it was this life experience, right, of going through all this. But really, I will say that, well, there were several things that happened. So when I became a young adult in my 20s, I started seeking out and learning about my own ethnic identity, started doing the work, started learning what does it mean to be Indian? And there was so much about my culture I didn't know. So yeah. I set out to learn and appreciate and reclaim that part of myself. But then years later, years went by. Okay, so let's just move up to, say, 2016, the political election, you know, everything that was happening in our country. And that was a huge turning point for me, actually.
Okay.
I will say that I started reading lots more books by people of color. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was on a journey to read and understand and learn from everyone and other people that I hadn't really spent time with and learning other perspectives. So I was immersing myself in that, and then everything happening in our country. And all of a sudden I felt like, you know, as an immigrant in this country, I knew I was an immigrant, but all of a sudden I felt that I wasn't welcome. And, and even though I had experienced all these other things while growing up, I felt personally targeted in a way that I had never been by politicians, and particular politicians. Yeah. And all of a sudden I felt like I needed to carry my passport with me everywhere I needed to go because I was afraid. I felt fear in a way that I had never felt before, that I could be stopped and I could be questioned, and my I'm a US citizen. My citizenship would be, you know, called into question. It was this entire unsettling feeling that I had never experienced to that degree. And that also was a huge turning point for me. And so it really started me on this journey of then really naming and exploring all of these things, like that internalized racism and that dialogue I had been having in my brain about whiteness and about who I was. And that I was somehow inferior and white culture was superior. And so all of that came to a head. And that was the start, I think, of all of this, even though I didn't name it as this book at the time. I started writing about it. I started thinking about it. I was reading other people. And that's how this book came. I would say it started back then.
Oh, wow. That's great. I mean, I was going to ask about how, you know, I've shifted a lot of my questions, you know, in regards to, you know, the shift that happened I would say globally as well. I mean, just in 2016, I mean, right. I mean, so much was came out in regards to, you know, how, you know, some of these social media sites use our information, what's being sold, you know, issues of privacy, you know, issue of fake news and you know, how misinformation, right, is, you know, guided us, you know, and driving so much of that is race and ethnicity. So I love how you define right here, you know, here, I mean, right up at the front, right? What is ethnic loneliness? And the story that got me that, you know, at the beginning here, this is on page 15 for those listening and following along. You said a good friend of yours suffered from an undefined chronic illness. That's actually been my daughter's experience. I mean, and you know, as a young woman, as a ethnic minority young woman, I remember one time, you know, you talk about just kind of how folks are dismissive. And it's the same thing. We've gone to doctors after doctors after doctors, and people are just, the test's negative. You know, I don't know. Are you menstruating? You know, it's just like, no, this there's something going on here. And I remember we went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor who that's his specialty. But then all of a sudden he turns into a psychologist and it's like, oh, well, you know, there's a possibility that she's just, you know, this stuff is just being made up and stuff. And I'm like, you know, what the hell are you talking about? So there's a sense of out there-ness, right? And you break it down like cultural isolation, lack of connection, identity conflicts. You talk about loss of cultural identity. Can you walk us through some of these as well? I mean, particularly, you know, think about social exclusion. I mean, you've already named, you know, some of it and just in your own experience. But, you know, how did you arrive at, you know, these particular categories here that you're defining and laying out for us?
Yeah. So, thank you. So, yeah, ethnic loneliness, you know, the way that I explain it is when we are isolated or disconnected or excluded as a result of our racial or ethnic identity. So, and for all of us, you know, for all of our multiple racial and ethnic identities, we can experience, you know, any of these or some of these or all of these, and we can experience them at different times and in different environments and in different situations. And so basically some of it was my experience. Some of it was, you know, reading about what other people have experienced, reading lots of books and trying to understand, you know, like I'm speaking as an Asian American woman. I don't necessarily know the experience. I don't know what it's like to walk into your shoes, Daniel, and experience. I can read about it and learn from you. And so I tried to read and understand so many other people's experiences too in trying to come up with some of these things. And some of these things are things I've been through. For example, you know, identity conflicts. I already mentioned a little bit about that. You know, I struggled with my sense of identity and I was kind of torn and I didn't actually know, like, who was I? Do I call myself American? Am I Indian American? At what point am I Asian American? Actually, when I was a child, I thought Asian American really referred to Chinese people. I didn't really know that it would also meant me. Just because I realized later I felt so like unrepresented or just like invisible in many ways. Like I wasn't seen, right? Even in forms and filling out forms and such. So I think some of these things are what immigrants experience. Some of these things are just being an ethnic minority in the United States. So I think it actually is kind of individualized too, to your own personal ethnic and racial identity.
No, absolutely. I think that, you know, just exactly what you're saying. And I think, you know, we're starting to learn more, right? Is in terms of being able to give each other, you know, the space, to learn more. I mean, yes, there's some major issues that are being presented to us as ethnic minorities, especially living here in the U.S. But it's just like there's a sense of like, okay, no, there's something we gotta go here. So let me just ask this, just for the listeners and whatnot, but why is it important to understand, define, and name ethnic loneliness in particular?
That is a really, really good question. So I think, well, one of the reasons it's really important is that, you know, the demographics of the United States is changing.
Yeah.
We are moving toward, you know, a non-white majority. So that means by the year 2045, I think it is we're going to have all races combined are going to be the majority. But that doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that things are going to change in terms of our structures and representation and access, right? And equity. Things are not necessarily going to be tipped just because we're a non-white majority. But what that means is we have to answer these questions because we're living in this society together, side by side. And we are an extremely lonely society right now already because loneliness is an epidemic, declared an epidemic some years ago.
Yeah.
Not only are we lonely, but we are also, we're disconnected from each other, but for ethnic and racial minorities, we are then, that's another level of separation. So we already have this, you know, lots of racial tension. So how are we going to address these questions and how are we going to live as neighbors and love our neighbors? We have to talk about these things and have conversations and name it. We have to name the fact that people feel marginalized. People feel isolated. We feel disconnected. We feel you know, that we are not represented. So we have to be having these conversations and thinking about it, that there are people who feel like they don't belong. Mm. And how are we going to create a sense of belonging in our society, in our communities, in our worship, houses of worship? How are we going to do that?
Woo. Yeah. Those are good meta questionings that I think there's a sense of this reckoning. So I gotta ask then. So how then would you say, I mean, right, there's this sense of pushback, for example, on critical race theory. So I'm a professor, and so, you know, I've been in the classroom for over two decades. And so critical race theory has just always kind of been kind of an insider's thing, right? It's like, it's a field of study. As with anything in the academy, at least from my perspective, you know, there's people who agree, disagree, push back on some of the research. And then all of a sudden this stuff started making its way into the, you know, pop culture sphere and got turned around real quick. We're teaching kids critical race theory, and all of a sudden people are taking all these hard stands, and you're right, it's leading to where we see ourselves now. You're banning books, and then people start getting into, of course, human sexuality from that. How would you recommend folks deal with particularly an environment that says, oh, you know, the wokeness is not of God, and, you know, it's kind of this anti-wokeness? And because there's a lot of, it's not just white folks, right? It's like there's a lot of ethnic minorities who are like, mm-hmm. Yeah, no. I mean, I saw a post the other day on Instagram, and it was, you know, the five, six comments. I know I shouldn't dive into the comments, but as a researcher, I'm always interested in how people communicate and engage with their own rhetoric. I mean, it was like five, six ethnic minorities who would just say, oh, yeah, anti-woke. How we go about navigating some of that stuff in this day and age, in the year of our Lord 2024, Santa?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you for that. Wow. That's really a great question. So I will just tell you, to be completely transparent with you, I was one of those people, Daniel.
Come on with it.
I was. And look, I changed and I learned. And I was living in my own echo chamber for so long. I was actually a debate coach for 10 years. And I was actually personally convicted, you know, as a coach, as a debate coach. While I was teaching my students, you have to see both sides of an issue. You have to, you know, when you go on a debate round, you have to know the pro and the con, because you don't, in one debate round, you have to be pro. And then on the next debate round, you have to be con on the same topic. So you have to know both sides really well. Yeah. And then I was really convicted that I didn't know both sides. Like, I was living my life and I was believing one side and one narrative, and I hadn't considered there wasn't all the other side of the story. So all the reading that I did helped me so much. And so I would say, like, you know, for people of color, we have to keep sharing our stories. We have to keep telling and sharing, because that helped me. Was learning and hearing other people's stories and reading their perspectives. So we have to keep doing that. And you know, I'm reminded, Daniel, of that verse. You know, it's not us who water. It's not us who put the seeds. But, you know, God is the one who's going to give the growth, right? He's the one. So we put our stories out there and we keep sharing. And we also acknowledge and name in ourselves and what we need to name and heal in ourselves. So we come as whole people. You know, we come as healed, whole people. Like, I had to heal from these things. And but now putting our stories out there, that's super important. And I know, like, it's not going to solve all of this. Like, it's to me, maybe it seems like a simple answer. And I don't know if I have any answers, but I do know, like, this is number one, I think, is reclaiming our identities and naming and awareness, right, of what is happening in our own lives. And number two is sharing our stories. And making sure that our stories are out there and continuing to do so. And just believing that it's going to make a difference, even though we may not be able to see it or we can't see the results of it. And it feels like maybe we feel invisible and nobody's listening. But I think that there eventually somebody will be listening. It's going to affect somebody. Somebody's watching. Always somebody's watching us and listening to us, you know. And we never know. So, that's a hard one.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I do think, too, that our sense of true belonging, we have to find that within ourselves and God. We have to come to a place where we know that we belong. And then from that place, then we can do whatever it is that we feel that we're being called to do in this world. Yeah. What's the way that we're being called to address this issue?
I love that. This is great. On so many levels, because I think, and thank you for sharing that. That takes a lot, right? I always say, you know, let me shame the devil and tell the truth. And once upon a time, I always tell my students, it's just like, you know, I was a Bible thumping, you know, it's like back in the day. I remember, so I did my dissertation looking at Tupac and his gospels. And, you know, back in the day, though, I was, you know, I'm old enough to remember when he was still alive and working with young people. And I was vehemently against secular rap and secular music. And so you're absolutely right. And just like putting it out to be like, yeah, you know, I was one of those people. I was there. It's like, you know, we, education and learning, right, is this journey. So I appreciate that. Thank you for sharing that. One of the things I will say for the readers that I really appreciated, and I didn't think I'd appreciate it as much, and especially in a book like this, is that you have questions and reflections at the end of chapters. And I'm like, oh, man, I ain't gonna front. Look, a lot of these books, they'll have questions and they're just like soft hitting. But you hitting on some stuff here. This is on page 64. This is at the end of chapter 3. You talk, you know, you ask, like, what are the standards of beauty? Have you internalized from the majority culture? Just that alone. I mean, that should give you pause. Just anyone listening and reading. This is why I think, you know, this book right here has got it's different. It sets out because you nuance your personal journey, a memoir-ish type of environment, but you also connect with, you know, what we're currently dealing with. And that question alone, what standards of beauty have you internalized from the majority culture? And then you go on writing, you know, why have you, you know, rejected your background? Can you talk, though, a little bit? And again, I just kind of, that's just, you know, praise for it. Again, anybody reading and engaging with this, you know, check them into the chapter questions out. Because, again, I appreciate how you nuanced those and connected it back as you think as a reader, as a writer. It's like, oh, okay, internalization. That's some deep stuff right there. But can you talk a little bit about the isolation, the other, you know, you wrote going right into chapter 4. And you talk a little bit about, you know, seeing beyond stereotypes, color blindness, and of course you get into the model minority myth, and then the ways we cope. Can you share a little bit? I know that's big, but I know you can pull something from that.
Yeah, for sure. So there's many ways that we cope, you know, with our internalized racism, or, you know, maybe our internalized ideas of beauty, or what we think is attractive, or how other people look at us. But, you know, I think that one of the ways that we cope, you know, is, you know, code switching. We go through this, yeah. You know, we change who we are and the way that we talk, just according to where we are. So we try to cope. And also, like, maybe we balance this dual identity. So one of the things that we do is we're trying to, for example, when I was going from one place to another, I was trying to figure out, well, who am I in this space? You know, do I need to be more Indian? Do I need to be more American? You know, exactly. Other people had their own perceptions or ideas of who I was, too. So we're balancing these dual or even multiple identities. And so all of this is very exhausting. You know, we're trying to survive. We're trying to figure out, how do we fit in? And what does it really mean to fit in? I mean, is that really belonging? Does that really mean that I have to fit in and change who I am? Because isn't belonging, doesn't it mean that maybe I can just show up as myself? So we employ all these strategies to try to maybe assimilate or fit in. And it leads to trauma. It leads to pain. It leads to exhaustion. And you know, it's not really being true to who we are. So it's very, I would say, creating personal and difficulties for ourselves when we're trying to survive. And we're not being fully ourselves and fully authentic and showing up in spaces where we are free to be ourselves and be authentic.
Yeah. That word, that authentic. This is good. Because I think there's a sense of, well, there's a couple different things. I think that word stands out to me, or particularly that, you know, that ideological, you know, thought process, you know, stands out just because, you know, to be authentic and what that looks like, particularly, you know, again, I'll speak from my experience, you know, being Black in the academy. I always say, you know, the academy, and just, you know, I believe just the way we look at education, especially here in the U.S., you know, it is a very Eurocentric model and stuff. And so much of that design, right, did not include ethnic minorities, right? I think I still believe education is important. I mean, I'll say this, you said, you know, Southern, you know, mindset. I mean, I grew up in a small Southern rural town where up until the sixth grade, history books, and I so wish I had a time machine, I could go back and get one of those history books that still said that the South had won the Civil War and that they granted the North favor and allowed Lincoln to live. I remember that, and you know, being authentic in spaces like that. I've also found that, you know, whiteness does not like our authenticity. At least once we come into our own and start defining, right, what we should be like. You know, so much of vacation Bible school curriculum, right, for years has been just one racial trope after another, right? If you think about Asian and Pan-Asian Americans, Pan-Asian just in general, African Americans, Pan-African Americans. I mean, you know, this is these racialized tropes that, you know, that show up. And, you know, some of those god-awful videos are now on Instagram and TikTok. For our amusement, but it still comes back to, right, this understanding of, like you said here, marginalized and stranded. You talk about on page 96, 45% of Black women have experienced intimate partner physical violence, intimate partner sexual violence, and or intimate partner stalking in their lifetimes. An estimated 51% of Black adult female homicides are related to intimate partner violence. And just looking and just from what that means and whew, you know, the depth of that. I want to go with one of your writing prompts here on page 101. It's just, you know, you said, I long to be represented in and what are some of those areas? I mean, obviously you're an author, successful, you doing your thing. But, you know, how have you engaged with that particular prompt or that, you know, I long to be represented in?
Great question. I just piggybacking on something you just said, you know, when we're showing up as ourselves and you said, yes, but we are not welcome to do that. And that is a huge tension that we live with. Right. So even though I say, you know, we want to do that, but you're absolutely right. It's not welcome. So we don't know when, you know, we're constantly juggling that tension of, you know, how do we show up? So, yeah. So I long to be represented in. One of the things was writing. And so one of the things that I think, as an author, I'm the first author that I read was Jhumpa Lahiri, who was South Asian. She wrote stories and she wrote stories about immigrants like myself. And so I finally saw myself for the first time, a writer was writing. We're seeing more, like, speaking as a South Asian woman, I'm seeing more women, for example, South Asian women, for example, in media. I'm seeing some in journalism and TV news and a few showing up on, you know, Netflix shows or some, you know, movies. Still not a ton, but a few showing up more in media and news spaces. There's still a wide, maybe politics is one area we're starting to see, you know, maybe one or two people, but there's still wide areas that don't have adequate representation, you know, in our workplaces, in our places of worship, in our schools, school leadership, perhaps in the academy. So there's so many places I think that we need to see a greater variety of representation of all the different ethnic minorities. Of course, not just Asians, but many, many different ethnic and racial groups. So I put that prompt in because, you know, for each person, that's going to be a different kind of a place and very personal. You know, for me, it was really life-changing for me to see an author, a South Asian woman author. So for someone else, it might be a different kind of representation. It could be in sports, you know, so.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, and I think that has been, you know, sort of the rub, right, for, you know, I think, you know, as I like to call them, the colonizers, right? It's like, because there's been a more of a representation, you know, particularly in film, television, music, and then, you know, things start to come out, right? Oh, this is just un-American and whatnot. I'll pull back for a second. Like, how some of the politics, I mean, you think about, you know, this is an election year. How some of that stuff affected you? How would you recommend us as we're heading into a very contentious political season, you know, engage in, you know, or not engage in some of this? You know, you said, you debate coaches, like, you know, it's like, do we hold up the banner in some of these conversations or not? I mean, I'd be curious what your thoughts are on where we're at right now. And again, just some of the pushback, and I'm particularly thinking, at least at the time of us recording this, you know, some of the protests that are happening on campuses, you know, across the country, you know, and we just kind of keep seeing hearing these blips and things of, you know, police terrorism. So I'd be curious, you know, how we engage with some of this, particularly for those of us who are sitting back and kind of seeing it through the gaze of our devices, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Right. We're just like, we are sitting in our, you know, rooms, our offices, our homes, and we're watching our screens and we're seeing protests happening, right, all over the country, and students speaking out. And, you know, I think, you know, for everyone, how do we engage with this political election? And I mean, first of all, here we are again, right? Here we go again. How can we be doing this all over again? So that is another huge thing that we're all dealing with. And honestly, I don't know. I'm sitting here thinking, here we go again. What am I going to do? How am I going to respond? And, you know, for each of us, I don't know. Like, one of the things that I think about is, for me and other people, how do our personalities play into? Because I feel like for some of us, you know, some of us may not be the protesting sign carrying type. So is there a place for all of us here to speak up? You know, what is it that we are in our platform or in our unique personality designed to do? You know, some people may be better at writing. Some people might be better at, you know, standing on a corner with a sign, and some people may be, you know, doing something else. I don't know. Some people have maybe podcast, and some people are, you know, I don't know. I think it's, we have to also do what we feel is emotionally safe and healthy for us, because this is tiring. This is exhausting. Yeah. So what is it that is also that we can do, but we respect our boundaries and stay healthy? So I don't know. That's probably a unique answer for each person. But we can't just, you know, we can't just step back and say, oh, this doesn't affect me. No, we're all affected. We are all, you know, belonging into this thing together. So it's quite a momentous historical thing that we're witnessing right now in our country. Mm-hmm. And it'll be, it's interesting to see what's going to happen. I mean, school is going to be out soon.
Right.
Universities will be out of session. And then what's going to happen? You know, the college students will be dissipating, going back to their homes and jobs and, you know, whatever they have going on for the summer. So what does that mean? You know, are they going to continue to pick up where they, you know, where they are? They're not all together. Right. So they're kind of, everybody's kind of separated, dissipated. So I'm not sure what that result is going to be.
Ooh, I love that. That is honest. That's good stuff. I think I love the chapter that you end with, chapter 10, A Better Country. And I think, you know, the honesty in all of this is what I appreciate, you know, the most, because even in your response there, it's just like, it's not like, you know, oh, there's these, we do these five things. I mean, it's been kind of my critique, if you will, of a lot of Christian publishing and even my own work with, you know, Christian publishers like IVP. Like, there's, you know, there's like, how can you tie this up at the end? You know, yes, it's bad, but how can you, you know, basically paint this rainbow? And I appreciate the honesty. It's like, yes, I think we have to, you know, just can't just sit here and think, oh, well, it doesn't affect me. What does that look like? How does truth telling, how does being authentic, how do we separate that? Because I'll be honest, I mean, I think what caught me about this particular book when it was sent out in terms of all these new publications are out was, again, the loneliness piece. And I think that's something that I think I have navigated for years. I would dare I say most of my life. And there was periods and moments of feeling, okay, I'm a part of something, I'm a part of not. I see you're here in the Midwest as well. I'm in the Chicagoland region. I go up to Milwaukee a lot and stuff. And so, you know, there's a sense that at least in Chicago, the neighborhoods are quarantined off. It's much more so coming from LA, right? And LA's got its own issues, but it's just much more so like, okay, I know I'm in the Polish neighborhood now. Okay, now I'm going to German, the old German. Then you got African-Americans, but then you got the rich African-Americans where Obama lived. Then you got, but then you got poor folks over here on the South and West side. And so, I don't know, I felt a sense of misdirection, if you will. Claude Steele calls it, you know, under the theory of disidentifying with things, you know, so that you can fit in better and whatnot. But in that process, right, we lose so much. So I appreciate this understanding of a better country. So I'm just going to ask you a question, because, again, these questions at the end, fam, I'm telling you, y'all need to be reading this stuff, man. What does belonging in a better country mean to you?
Mm. That is a great question. Thank you for asking me back. yeah, I guess I should have had that written down. I should answer my own question. For in this last chapter, I think I try to explain, you know, what does this mean? And what does this look like? Let's be realistic about what's happening, and let's name the reality. But let's also mention the fact that we are, we also look for there. We believe in a greater hope, right? We believe that, you know, there is a plan of redemption here. So for me, I need to ask myself, you know, how do I want to show up in the world? Who is it that I want to be? And that is a very critical question for me to answer. How am I going to show up, and who do I want to be? And I want to be real, I want to be authentic, and I want to be in a place where I can be that person. So for me, that means finding a safe community of people where I can be, because I know that outside of that, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not going to be accepted. I will be rejected. I can't know what's going to happen when I walk into that room. I expect this sense of disbelonging when I walk into, you know, these other spaces. So where do I find this sense of belonging? You know, what am I going to do to alleviate this kind of loneliness? And there's different kinds of loneliness, right? But with ethnic loneliness, I think I need to find that community of other like-minded people who understand what it's like to live in this brown body, where I don't have to explain myself, and where I can just show up and we get it. Like, we all get it. So for me, that is finding that safe community. And that's going to help me to live in a broader sense, outside of that community, in the greater world, the community, and all of the other things that we do in life. So part of it is here, but part of it is also afterward, we believe in a better hope. And we do believe God's going to redeem all of this. He's a redeemer of culture and redeemer of our ethnicities and everything that we have done to mar his creation. So, and when I say mar his creation, I mean all of us people, what we have done to mar the image of God in other people. So I think it's both, believing that my safe community is kind of my safe space. Regardless of what happens outside, I know that I have a sense of belonging there. And then I belong to God. I belong to myself authentically. I'm going to be who I am. I belong to the safe community. I belong to God. And those are some places where I can find that country, right? That country that I'm looking for.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah, no, that's deep. That's deep. I love it. I love it. Yeah, again, the flow and style of what you put together here, I think, is really, really good. And again, I'm saying that, you know, both from a teaching and just a personal perspective in what you've put here together in this text. And so I'm definitely encouraging my listeners to go check this out. And read it and engage with it, because I think this is you hit a nerve in where we find ourselves. Like you said, loneliness is big. I just saw another NPR report last week talking about just like basically the CDC is just like, we got to do something about this. Like this is
right.
Just loneliness in general. Like this isn't good.
That was bad. There was,
yeah. What's giving you hope right now?
What's giving me hope is, you know, people like you talking about these things and, you know, the things that you're sharing and you're doing. I have a lot of hope. I get a lot of hope from the natural world, just the beauty of the natural world and the renewal, the rejuvenation, you know, the whole process. In the natural world gives me a lot of hope. I see a lot of, you know, metaphors there for us. I see a lot of hope in young people, you know, all of our young people who care. You know, they care about things that matter. They care about showing up authentically and real. And I absolutely love that. And I think you see that in your students too, I'm sure. Like, you know, the students today, like they care about other people. They care about truth. They care about life. They care about genocide. They care about what's happening in our world, and they're not staying silent. That gives me a lot of hope. I see hope everywhere I turn around.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Are you reading anything current that is good and juicy and spicy?
Good and juicy and spicy, though. I don't know. So I just finished reading. This was just a delightful book that I just finished. It's called The Comfort of Crows by Margaret Renkel. And she, because I grew up in Alabama, so she grew up in South Alabama. And she's a writer for the New York Times. And she wrote this book about kind of like a memoir. And she talks about the beauty of her garden and birds and the natural world. And you know, I read that just very recently. It really, really was like a healing thing for me and just enjoyable, like an enjoyable read, a restful read, because I did so much heavy reading for this book. I read so much.
Yeah.
I needed something light, something that was a little restorative to me. And so that's what I read.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I say that a lot. It's like when I read something, when I watch something that's really heavy, and I recently just went through the it's on Netflix. It's on the war and the Cold War and everything. And it's like an 8-part series. And I was like, "Woo! I need a palate cleanser, man. This was too much." So no, I appreciate that. I have to check that out. I haven't read that. So that's great. Prasanta, this has been great. I feel like we've only begun to scratch the surface. Being that you're just in Milwaukee, I may have to hit you up to make a trip down here to Chicago, have you out on campus to talk some more, particularly to our students. I think a lot of our students need to hear this in what you're talking about, what you're engaging with, because I think the reality of it is that you're absolutely right. I mean, this just loneliness is an epidemic, and then you add on race and ethnicity and all the intersections, gender, human sexuality, and it can put people out there and, you know, drive people to do crazy things, suicidal thoughts and other things that come out of that. So thank you for putting together this work. Where can people find you? Hey, let me give you a grant to write the next book. Let me, you know, get you a MacArthur Genius grant.
Oh my goodness. Oh my. Yes, please. For sure. No, you can find me at my website, persantaverma.com. I'm on Instagram at persantaverma. Feel free to connect with me. I would love to continue this conversation with you. The book is available everywhere books are sold. Thank you so much for having me, Daniel. I really, it was a pleasure.
No, absolutely. Thank you so much. And as always, those listening, I'll put these in the show notes and, you know, put all these links, especially the link to your text. Again, Persanta, thank you so much. I hope to have you back on to talk about some more things, but thank you for today.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
We live in an era of unprecedented access to information, news, and media. But what happens when all that information leads you to suddenly realize you spent the majority of your childhood in a cult? Well, we can tell you. Join me, Jessica Goforth, and Kathleen Reynolds as we take you into the world of cult recovery after all the emotional, psychological, financial, and sexual abuse we experienced as part of Bill Gothard's Advanced Training Institute. On our podcast called Leaving the Village, we talk candidly about our journey out and interview other survivors whose experiences boggle your mind as scandals continue to rock the twisted world of IBLP. Subscribe to Leaving the Village today so you don't miss a single episode.